Earnshaw blushed crimson when his cousin made this revelation of his private literary accumulations, and stammered an indignant denial of her accusations. "Mr. Hareton is desirous of increasing his amount of knowledge," I said, coming to his rescue. "He is not envious, but emulous of your attainments. He'll be a clever scholar in a few years." "And he wants me to sink into a dunce meantime," answered Catherine. "Yes, I hear him trying to spell and read to himself, and pretty blunders he makes. I wish you would repeat Chevy Chase as you did yesterday. It was extremely funny. I heard you, and I heard you turning over the dictionary to seek out the hard words, and then cursing because you couldn't read their explanations." The young man evidently thought it too bad that he should be laughed at for his ignorance, and then laughed at for trying to remove it. I had a similar notion, and remembering Mrs. Dean's anecdote of his first attempt at enlightening the darkness in which he had been reared, I observed, "But, Mrs. Heathcliff, we have each had a commencement, and each stumbled and tottered on the threshold. Had our teachers scorned instead of aiding us, we should stumble and totter yet." "Oh," she replied, "I don't wish to limit his acquirements. Still, he has no right to appropriate what is mine, and make it ridiculous to me with his vile mistakes and mispronunciations. Those books, both prose and verse, are consecrated to me by other associations, and I hate to have them debased and profaned in his mouth. Besides, of all he has selected my favourite pieces, that I love the most to repeat, as if out of deliberate malice." Hareton's chest heaved in silence a minute. He laboured under a severe sense of mortification and wrath, which it was no easy task to suppress. I rose, and, from a gentlemanly idea of relieving his embarrassment, took up my station in the doorway, surveying the external prospect as I stood. He followed my example and left the room, but presently reappeared, bearing half a dozen volumes in his hands, which he threw into Catherine's lap, exclaiming, "Take them. I never want to hear or read or think of them again." "I won't have them now," she answered. "I shall connect them with you, and hate them." She opened one that had obviously been often turned over, and read a portion in the drawling tone of a beginner, then laughed and threw it from her. "And listen," she continued provokingly, commencing a verse of an old ballad in the same fashion. But his self-love would endure no further torment. I heard, and not altogether disapprovingly, a manual check given to her saucy tongue. The little wretch had done her utmost to hurt her cousin's sensitive, though uncultivated, feelings, and a physical argument was the only mode he had of balancing the account, and repaying its effects on the inflictor. He afterwards gathered the books and hurled them on the fire. I read in his countenance what anguish it was to offer that sacrifice to spleen. I fancied that as they consumed, he recalled the pleasure they had already imparted, and the triumph and ever-increasing pleasure he had anticipated from them. And I fancied I guessed the incitement to his secret studies also. He had been content with daily labour and rough animal enjoyments, till Catherine crossed his path. Shame at her scorn, and hope of her approval, were his first prompters to higher pursuits, and instead of guarding him from one and winning him to the other, his endeavours to raise himself had produced just the contrary result. "Yes, that's all the good that such a brute as you can get from them," cried Catherine, sucking her damaged lip and watching the conflagration with indignant eyes. "You'd better hold your tongue now," he answered fiercely, and his agitation precluded further speech. He advanced hastily to the entrance, where I made way for him to pass. But ere he had crossed the doorstones, Mr. Heathcliff, coming up the causeway, encountered him, and laying hold of his shoulder, asked, "What's to do now, my lad?" Not, he said, and broke away to enjoy his grief and anger in solitude. Heathcliff gazed after him, and sighed. "It will be odd if I thwart myself," he muttered, unconscious that I was behind him. "But when I look for his father in his face, I find her every day more. How the devil is he so like? I can hardly bear to see him. He bent his eyes to the ground and walked moodily in. There was a restless, anxious expression in his countenance I had never remarked there before, and he looked sparer in person. His daughter-in-law, on perceiving him through the window, immediately escaped to the kitchen, so that I remained alone. "I'm glad to see you out of doors again, Mr. Lockwood," he said, in reply to my greeting. "From selfish motives, partly. I don't think I could readily supply your loss in this desolation. I've wondered more than once what brought you here." "An idle whim, I fear, sir," was my answer. "Or else an idle whim is going to spirit me away. I shall set out for London next week, and I must give you warning that I feel no disposition to retain Thrushcross Grange beyond the 12 months I agreed to rent it. I believe I shall not live there any more."
"Oh, indeed. You're tired of being banished from the world, are you?" he said. "But if you be coming to plead off paying for a place you won't occupy, your journey is useless. I never relent in exacting my due from anyone."
"I'm coming to plead off nothing about it," I exclaimed, considerably irritated. "Should you wish it, I'll settle with you now." And I drew my notebook from my pocket.
"No, no," he replied coolly. "You'll leave sufficient behind to cover your debts, if you fail to return. I'm not in such a hurry. Sit down, and take your dinner with us. A guest that is safe from repeating his visit can generally be made welcome. Catherine, bring the things in. Where are you?"
Catherine reappeared, bearing a tray of knives and forks.
"You may get your dinner with Joseph," muttered Heathcliff aside, "and remain in the kitchen till he is gone."
She obeyed his directions very punctually. Perhaps she had no temptation to transgress. Living among clowns and misanthropists, she probably cannot appreciate a better class of people when she meets them. With Mr. Heathcliff, grim and saturnine on the one hand, and Hareton absolutely dumb on the other, I made a somewhat cheerless meal, and bade adieu early. I would have departed by the back way to get a last glimpse of Catherine, and annoy old Joseph, but Hareton received orders to lead up my horse, and my host himself escorted me to the door, so I could not fulfil my wish. "How dreary life gets over in that house," I reflected, while riding down the road. "What a realization of something more romantic than a fairy tale it would have been for Mrs. Linton Heathcliff had she and I struck up an attachment, as her good nurse desired, and migrated together into the stirring atmosphere of the town." Chapter 32 1802 This September I was invited to devastate the moors of a friend in the north, and on my journey to his abode I unexpectedly came within 15 miles of Gimmerton. The ostler at a roadside public house was holding a pail of water to refresh my horses, when a cart of very green oats, newly reaped, passed by, and he remarked,
"Yon's fra Gimmerton, na. They're allus 3 week after other folk with their harvest."
"Gimmerton," I repeated. My residence in that locality had already grown dim and dreamy. "Ah, I know. How far is it from this?"
"Up on 14 mile o' the hills, and a rough road," he answered.
A sudden impulse seized me to visit Thrushcross Grange. It was scarcely noon, and I conceived that I might as well pass the night under my own roof as in an inn. Besides, I could spare a day easily to arrange matters with my landlord, and thus save myself the trouble of invading the neighbourhood again. Having rested a while, I directed my servant to inquire the way to the village. And, with great fatigue to our beasts, we managed the distance in some 3 hours. I left him there, and proceeded down the valley alone. The grey church looked greyer, and the lonely churchyard lonelier. I distinguished a moor sheep cropping the short turf on the graves. It was sweet, warm weather, too warm for travelling. But the heat did not hinder me from enjoying the delightful scenery above and below. Had I seen it nearer August, I am sure it would have tempted me to waste a month among its solitudes. In winter, nothing more dreary. In summer, nothing more divine than those glens shut in by hills and those bluff, bold swells of heath. I reached the Grange before sunset, and knocked for admittance, but the family had retreated into the back premises, I judged, by one thin blue wreath curling from the kitchen chimney, and they did not hear. I rode into the court. Under the porch a girl of 9 or 10 sat knitting, and an old woman reclined on the house steps, smoking a meditative pipe. "Is Mrs. Dean within?" I demanded of the dame.
"Mistress Dean? Nay," she answered. "She doesn't bide here. She was up at the Heights."
"Are you the housekeeper, then?" I continued.
"Eh, I keep the house," she replied.
"Well, I'm Mr. Lockwood, the master. Are there any rooms to lodge me in, I wonder? I wish to stay all night."
"Master," she cried in astonishment, "what, whoever knew you were coming? You should have sent word. There's nowt nor the drine and menthful about the place. Now there isn't."
She threw down her pipe and bustled in. The girl followed, and I entered too, soon perceiving that her report was true, and, moreover, that I had almost upset her wits by my unwelcome apparition. I bade her be composed. I would go out for a walk, and meantime she must try to prepare a corner of a sitting-room for me to sup in, and a bedroom to sleep in. No sweeping and dusting, only good fire and dry sheets were necessary. She seemed willing to do her best, though she thrust the hearth-brush into the grates in mistake for the poker, and malappropriated several other articles of her craft, but I retired, confiding in her energy for a resting-place against my return. Wuthering Heights was the goal of my proposed excursion. An afterthought brought me back when I had quitted the court. "All well at the Heights?" I inquired of the woman.
"Eh, for our tea now," she answered, scurrying away with a pan of hot cinders.
I would have asked why Mrs. Dean had deserted the Grange, but it was impossible to delay her at such a crisis, so I turned away and made my exit, rambling leisurely along, with the glow of a sinking sun behind and the mild glory of a rising moon in front, one fading and the other brightening, as I quitted the park and climbed the stony by-road branching off to Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling. Before I arrived in sight of it, all that remained of day was a beamless amber light along the west. But I could see every pebble on the path and every blade of grass by that splendid moon. I had neither to climb the gate nor to knock. It yielded to my hand. "That is an improvement," I thought. And I noticed another, by the aid of my nostrils, a fragrance of stocks and wallflowers wafted on the air from amongst the homely fruit trees. Both doors and lattices were open, and yet, as is usually the case in a coal district, a fine red fire illumined the chimney. The comfort which the eye derives from it renders the extra heat endurable. But the house of Wuthering Heights is so large that the inmates have plenty of space for withdrawing out of its influence, and accordingly what inmates there were had stationed themselves not far from one of the windows. I could both see them and hear them talk before I entered, and looked and listened in consequence, being moved thereto by a mingled sense of curiosity and envy that grew as I lingered. "Contrary," said a voice as sweet as a silver bell. "That for the third time, you dunce. I'm not going to tell you again. Recollect, or I'll pull your hair."
"Contrary, then," answered another in deep but softened tones. "And now kiss me for minding so well."
"No, read it over first correctly, without a single mistake." The male speaker began to read. He was a young man, respectably dressed, and seated at a table, having a book before him. His handsome features glowed with pleasure, and his eyes kept impatiently wandering from the page to a small white hand over his shoulder, which recalled him by a smart slap on the cheek whenever its owner detected such signs of inattention. Its owner stood behind, her light shining ringlets blending at intervals with his brown looks as she bent to superintend his studies. And her face, it was lucky he could not see her face, or he would never have been so steady. I could, and bit my lip in spite at having thrown away the chance I might have had of doing something besides staring at its smiting beauty. The task was done, not free from further blunders, but the pupil claimed a reward, and received at least 5 kisses, which, however, he generously returned. Then they came to the door, and from their conversation I judged they were about to issue out and have a walk on the moors. I suppose I should be condemned in Hareton Earnshaw's heart, if not by his mouth, to the lowest pit in the infernal regions, if I showed my unfortunate person in his neighbourhood then. And, feeling very mean and malignant, I skulked round to seek refuge in the kitchen. There was unobstructed admittance on that side also. And at the door sat my old friend Nellie Dean, sewing and singing a song, which was often interrupted from within by harsh words of scorn and intolerance uttered in far from musical accents.
"I'd rather by the half of 'em swearing in me lugs for morn to neat nor hearken ye howsoever,"
said the tenant of the kitchen in answer to an unheard speech of Nelly's.
"It's a blazing shame that I cannot open to blessed book, but ye set up them glories to Satan and all to flaysome wickednesses that ever were born into the world. Oh, ye're a right knout, and shoes another, and that poor lad'll be lost atween ye. Poor lad," he added with a groan. "He's witched, I'm sartin on't. O Lord, judge 'em, for there's no the law nor justice among we're rulers."
"No, or we shall be sitting in flaming faggots, I suppose," retorted the singer. "But whisht, old man, and read your Bible like a Christian, and never mind me. This is Fairy Annie's Wedding, a bonny tune. It goes to a dance."
Mrs. Dean was about to recommence when I advanced, and recognizing me directly, she jumped to her feet, crying,
"Why, bless you, Mr. Lockwood, how could you think of returning in this way? All shut up at Thrushcross Grange? You should have given us notice."
"I've arranged to be accommodated there for as long as I shall stay," I answered. "I depart again tomorrow." "And how are you transplanted here, Mrs. Dean? Tell me that."
"Zillah left, and Mr. Heathcliff wished me to come soon after you went to London, and stay till you returned. But step in, pray. Have you walked from Gimmerton this evening?"
"From the Grange," I replied. "And while they make me lodging room there, I want to finish my business with your master, because I don't think of having another opportunity in a hurry."
"What business, sir?" said Nelly, conducting me into the house. "He's gone out at present, and won't return soon."
"About the rent," I answered.
"Oh, then it is with Mrs. Heathcliff you must settle," she observed. "Or rather with me. She has not learnt to manage her affairs yet, and I act for her. There's nobody else."
I looked surprised.
"Ah, you have not heard of Heathcliff's death, I see," she continued.
"Heathcliff dead?" I exclaimed, astonished. "How long ago?"
3 months since. But sit down and let me take your hat, and I'll tell you all about it. Stop, you've had nothing to eat, have you?"
"I want nothing. I have ordered supper at home. You sit down, too.
I never dreamt of his dying."
"Let me hear how it came to pass. You say you don't expect them back for some time, the young people."
"No. I have to scold them every evening for their late rambles, but they don't care for me. At least have a drink of our old ale. It will do you good. You seem weary."
She hastened to fetch it before I could refuse,
and I heard Joseph asking whether it weren't a crying scandal that she should have followers at her time of life, and then to get them jocks out of Timaster's cellar, a fair shame to bide still and see it. She did not stay to retaliate, but re-entered in a minute bearing a reaming silver pint, whose contents I lauded with becoming earnestness. And afterwards she furnished me with the sequel of Heathcliff's history. He had a queer end, as she expressed it.
I was summoned to Wuthering Heights within a fortnight of your leaving us, and I obeyed joyfully for Catherine's sake. My first interview with her grieved and shocked me. She had altered so much since our separation. Mr. Heathcliff did not explain his reasons for taking a new mind about my coming here. He only told me he wanted me, and he was tired of seeing Catherine. I must make the little parlour my sitting room and keep her with me. It was enough if he were obliged to see her once or twice a day. She seemed pleased at this arrangement, and by degrees I smuggled over a great number of books and other articles that had formed her amusement at the Grange, and flattered myself we should get on in tolerable comfort. The delusion did not last long. Catherine, contented at first, in a brief space grew irritable and restless. For one thing, she was forbidden to move out of the garden, and it fretted her sadly to be confined to its narrow bounds as spring drew on. For another, in following the house, I was forced to quit her frequently, and she complained of loneliness. She preferred quarrelling with Joseph in the kitchen to sitting at peace in her solitude. I did not mind their skirmishes, but Hareton was often obliged to seek the kitchen also when the master wanted to have the house to himself. And though in the beginning she either left it at his approach or quietly joined in my occupations and shunned remarking or addressing him, and though he was always as sullen and silent as possible, after a while she changed her behaviour and became incapable of letting him alone, talking at him, commenting on his stupidity and idleness, expressing her wonder how he could endure the life he lived, how he could sit a whole evening staring into the fire and dozing. "He's just like a dog, is he not, Ellen?" she once observed. "Or a cart-horse. He does his work, eats his food, and sleeps eternally. What a blank, dreary mind he must have. Do you ever dream, Hareton? And if you do, what is it about? But you can't speak to me." Then she looked at him, but he would neither open his mouth nor look again. "He's perhaps dreaming now," she continued. He twitched his shoulder as Juno twitches hers. "Ask him, Ellen. Mr. Hareton will ask the master to send you upstairs if you don't behave," I said. He had not only twitched his shoulder, but clenched his fist as if tempted to use it. "I know why Hareton never speaks when I am in the kitchen," she exclaimed on another occasion. "He is afraid I shall laugh at him. Ellen, what do you think? He began to teach himself to read once, and because I laughed, he burned his books and dropped it. Was he not a fool?" "Were you not naughty?" I said. "Answer me that." "Perhaps I was," she went on. "But I did not expect him to be so silly. Hareton, if I give you a book, would you take it now?" "I'll try." She placed one she had been perusing on his hand. He flung it off and muttered if she did not give over, he would break her neck. "Well, I shall put it here," she said, "in the table drawer, and I'm going to bed." Then she whispered me to watch whether he touched it, and departed. But he would not come near it, and so I informed her in the morning, to her great disappointment. I saw she was sorry for his persevering sulkiness and indolence. Her conscience reproved her for frightening him off improving himself. She had done it effectually. But her ingenuity was at work to remedy the injury. While I ironed or pursued other such stationary employments as I could not well do in the parlour, she would bring some pleasant volume and read it aloud to me. When Hareton was there, she generally paused in an interesting part and left the book lying about. That she did repeatedly, but he was as obstinate as a mule, and instead of snatching at her bait, in wet weather, he took to smoking with Joseph, and they sat like automatons, one on each side of the fire, the elder happily too deaf to understand her wicked nonsense, as he would have called it, the younger doing his best to seem to disregard it. On fine evenings, the latter followed his shooting expeditions, and Catherine yawned and sighed, and teased me to talk to her, and ran off into the court or garden the moment I began, and, as a last resource, cried, and said she was tired of living, her life was useless. Mr. Heathcliff, who grew more and more disinclined to society, had almost banished Earnshaw from his apartment. Owing to an accident at the commencement of March, he became for some days a fixture in the kitchen. His gun burst while out on the hills by himself. A splinter cut his arm, and he lost a good deal of blood before he could reach home. The consequence was that perforce he was condemned to the fireside and tranquillity till he made it up again. It suited Catherine to have him there. At any rate, it made her hate her room upstairs more than ever, and she would compel me to find out business below, that she might accompany me. On Easter Monday, Joseph went to Gimmerton Fair with some cattle, and in the afternoon I was busy getting up linen in the kitchen. Earnshaw sat, morose as usual, at the chimney corner, and my little mistress was beguiling an idle hour with drawing pictures on the window panes, varying her amusement by smothered bursts of song and whispered ejaculations and quick glances of annoyance and impatience in the direction of her cousin, who steadfastly smoked and looked into the grate. At a notice that I could do with her no longer intercepting my light, she removed to the hearthstone. I bestowed little attention on her proceedings, but presently I heard her begin. "I found out, Hareton, that I want... that I'm glad that I should like you to be my cousin now, if you had not grown so cross to me and so rough." Hareton returned no answer. "Hareton? Hareton? Hareton? Do you hear?" she continued.
"Get off with you," he growled with uncompromising gruffness.
"Let me take that pipe," she said, cautiously advancing her hand and abstracting it from his mouth. Before he could attempt to recover it, it was broken and behind the fire. He swore at her and seized another. "Stop!" she cried. "You must listen to me first, and I can't speak while those clouds are floating in my face."
"Will you go to the devil?"
he exclaimed ferociously. "And let me be." "No," she persisted. "I won't. I can't tell what to do to make you talk to me, and you are determined not to understand. When I call you stupid, I don't mean anything. I don't mean that I despise you. Come, you shall take notice of me, Hareton. You are my cousin, and you shall own me."
"I shall have naught to do with you and your mucky pride, and your damned mocking tricks," he answered. "I'll go to hell, body and soul, before I look sideways after you again. Side out at gate now, this minute."
Catherine frowned and retreated to the window seat, chewing her lip, and endeavouring, by humming an eccentric tune, to conceal a growing tendency to sob. "You should be friends with your cousin, Mr. Hareton," I interrupted, "since she repents of her sauciness. It would do you a great deal of good. It would make you another man to have her for a companion."
"A companion?" he cried. "When she hates me, and does not think me fit to wipe her shoon? Nay, if it made me a king, I'd not be scorned for seeking her goodwill any more."
"It is not I who hate you. It is you who hate me," wept Cathy, no longer disguising her trouble. "You hate me as much as Mr. Heathcliff does, and more."
"You're a damned liar," began Earnshaw. "Why have I made him angry by taking your part then 100 times? and that when you sneered at and despised me and go on plaguing me, and I'll step in yonder and say you worried me out the kitchen.
I didn't know you took my part, she answered, drying her eyes. And I was miserable and bitter at everybody. But now I thank you and beg you to forgive me. What can I do besides?
She returned to the hearth and frankly extended her hand. He blackened and scowled like a thundercloud and kept his fists resolutely clenched and his gaze fixed on the ground. Catherine, by instinct, must have divined it was obdurate perversity and not dislike that prompted this dogged conduct, for, after remaining an instant undecided, she stooped and impressed on his cheek a gentle kiss. The little rogue thought I had not seen her, and drawing back, she took her former station by the window, quite demurely. I shook my head reprovingly, and then she blushed and whispered,
"Well, what should I have done, Ellen? He wouldn't shake hands and he wouldn't look. I must show him some way that I like him, that I want to be friends."
Whether the kiss convinced Hareton, I cannot tell. He was very careful for some minutes that his face should not be seen, and when he did raise it, he was sadly puzzled where to turn his eyes. Catherine employed herself in wrapping a handsome book neatly in white paper, and having tied it with a bit of ribbon and addressed it to Mr. Hareton Earnshaw, she desired me to be her ambassadress and convey the present to its destined recipient.
"And tell him, if he'll take it, I'll come and teach him to read it right," she said. "And if he refuse it, I'll go upstairs and never tease him again."
I carried it and repeated the message, anxiously watched by my employer. Hareton would not open his fingers, so I laid it on his knee. He did not strike it off either. I returned to my work. Catherine leaned her head and arms on the table till she heard the slight rustle of the covering being removed. Then she stole away and quietly seated herself beside her cousin. He trembled, and his face glowed. All his rudeness and all his surly harshness had deserted him. He could not summon courage at first to utter a syllable in reply to her questioning look and her murmured petition.
"Say you forgive me, Hareton. Do. You can make me so happy by speaking that little word."
He muttered something inaudible. "And you'll be my friend?" added Catherine, interrogatively.
"Nay, you'll be ashamed of me every day of your life," he answered, "and the more ashamed, the more you know me, and I cannot bide it."
"So you won't be my friend?"
she said, smiling as sweet as honey and creeping close up. I overheard no further distinguishable talk, but, on looking round again, I perceived two such radiant countenances bent over the page of the accepted book that I did not doubt the treaty had been ratified on both sides, and the enemies were, thenceforth, sworn allies. The work they studied was full of costly pictures, and those and their position had charm enough to keep them unmoved till Joseph came home. He, poor man, was perfectly aghast at the spectacle of Catherine seated on the same bench with Hareton Earnshaw, leaning a hand on his shoulder, and confounded at his favourite's endurance of a proximity. It affected him too deeply to allow an observation on the subject that night. His emotion was only revealed by the immense sighs he drew as he solemnly spread his large Bible on the table and overlaid it with dirty banknotes from his pocket-book, the produce of the day's transactions. At length, he summoned Hareton from his seat.
"Tuck these into your maister, lad," he said, "and bide there. I'se come up to my own room. This oil's neither menceful nor seemly for us. We mun side out and see each another."
"Come, Catherine," I said. "We must side out, too. I've done my ironing. Are you ready to go?"
"It is not 8 o'clock," she answered, rising unwillingly. Hareton, I'll leave this book upon the chimney-piece, and I'll bring some more tomorrow.
"Any books that you leave, I shall take him to the arse," said Joseph. "And it'll be Mitch if you find them again. So, you may please your sin."
Cathy threatened that his library should pay for hers, and, smiling as she passed Hareton, went singing upstairs. Lighter of heart, I venture to say, than ever she had been under that roof before, except perhaps during her earliest visits to Linton. The intimacy thus commenced grew rapidly, though it encountered temporary interruptions. Earnshaw was not to be civilized with a wish, and my young lady was no philosopher and no paragon of patience. But both their minds tending to the same point, one loving and desiring to esteem, and the other loving and desiring to be esteemed, they contrived in the end to reach it. You see, Mr. Lockwood, it was easy enough to win Mrs. Heathcliff's heart. But now I am glad you did not try. The crown of all my wishes will be the union of those two. I shall envy no one on their wedding day. There won't be a happier woman than myself in England.
Chapter 33.
On the morrow of that Monday, Earnshaw, being still unable to follow his ordinary employments and therefore remaining about the house, I speedily found it would be impracticable to retain my charge beside me as heretofore. She got downstairs before me, and out into the garden, where she had seen her cousin performing some easy work. And when I went to bid them come to breakfast, I saw she had persuaded him to clear a large space of ground from currant and gooseberry bushes, and they were busy planning together an importation of plants from the Grange. I was terrified at the devastation which had been accomplished in a brief half-hour. The blackcurrant trees were the apple of Joseph's eye, and she had just fixed her choice of a flower-bed in the midst of them. "There! That will be all shown to the master," I exclaimed, "the minute it is discovered, and what excuse have you to offer for taking such liberties with the garden? We shall have a fine explosion on the head of it, see if we don't. Mr. Hareton, I wonder you should have no more wit than to go and make that mess at her bidding." "Oh, I'd forgotten they were Joseph's," answered Earnshaw, rather puzzled. "But I'll tell him I did it." We always ate our meals with Mr. Heathcliff. I held the mistress's post in making tea and carving, so I was indispensable at table. Catherine usually sat by me, but today she stole nearer to Hareton, and I presently saw she would have no more discretion in her friendship than she had in her hostility. "Now mind you don't talk with and notice your cousin too much," were my whispered instructions as we entered the room. "It will certainly annoy Mr. Heathcliff, and he'll be mad at you both." "I'm not going to," she answered. The minute after, she had sidled to him, and was sticking primroses in his plate of porridge. He dared not speak to her there. He dared hardly look. And yet she went on teasing, till he was twice on the point of being provoked to laugh. I frowned, and then she glanced towards the master, whose mind was occupied on other subjects than his company, as his countenance evinced. And she grew serious for an instant, scrutinizing him with deep gravity. Afterwards she turned and recommenced her nonsense. At last Hareton uttered a smothered laugh. Mr. Heathcliff started. His eye rapidly surveyed our faces. Catherine met it with her accustomed look of nervousness and yet defiance, which he abhorred.
"It is as well you are out of my reach," he exclaimed. "What fiend possesses you to stare back at me, continually, with those infernal eyes? Down with them, and don't remind me of your existence again. I thought I had cured you of laughing."
"It was me," muttered Hareton.
"What do you say?"
demanded the master. Hareton looked at his plate, and did not repeat the confession. Mr. Heathcliff looked at him a bit, and then silently resumed his breakfast and his interrupted musing. We had nearly finished, and the two young people prudently shifted wider asunder, so I anticipated no further disturbance during that sitting, when Joseph appeared at the door, revealing by his quivering lip and furious eyes that the outrage committed on his precious shrubs was detected. He must have seen Cathy and her cousin about the spot before he examined it, for while his jaws worked like those of a cow chewing its cud and rendered his speech difficult to understand, he began,
"I'm going to have my wage and I'm going to go. I had aimed to do where I'd served for 60 years, and I thought I'd lug me books up to garret and all me bits of stuff, and they should have to kitchen to theirself for sake of quietness. It were hard to gee up me own hearthstone, and I thought I could do that, but now choose to hand my garden from me. And by the art, maester, I cannot stand it. You may bend to your oak, and you will. I know and used it. An old man doesn't so in get used to new burthens. I'd rather have my bite and my sup wi' a damarant road." Now, idiot," interrupted Heathcliff, "cut it short. What's your grievance? I'll interfere in no quarrels between you and Nelly. She may thrust you into the coal hole for anything I care." "It's no one, Nelly," answered Joseph. "I shouldn't shift for Nelly. Nasty ill now to shoe is. Thank God, shoe cannot stay up soul to nobody. She were never so handsome, but what a body mud look at her about winking. Is yon flay some graceless queen what's witched to a lad, wi' her bold een and her forrid ways, till, nay, it fair bursts my heart. He's forgotten all I done for him, and made on him, and goin' and riven up all row at grandest currant trees in garden."
And here he lamented outright, unmanned by a sense of his bitter injuries and Earnshaw's ingratitude and dangerous condition.
"Is the fool drunk?"
asked Mr. Heathcliff.
"Hareton, is it you he's finding fault with?"
"I've pulled up 2 or 3 bushes," replied the young man. "But I'm going to set 'em again."
"And why have you pulled 'em up?"
said the master. Catherine wisely put in her tongue.
"We wanted to plant some flowers there," she cried. "I'm the only person to blame, for I wished him to do it."
"And who the devil gave you leave to touch a stick about the place?"
demanded her father-in-law, much surprised.
"And who ordered you to obey her?"
he added, turning to Hareton. The latter was speechless. His cousin replied,
"You shouldn't grudge a few yards of earth for me to ornament, when you have taken all my land."
"Your land, insolent slut! You never had any," said Heathcliff.
"And my money,"
she continued, returning his angry glare, and meantime biting a piece of crust, the remnant of her breakfast.
"Silence!"
he exclaimed.
"Get done, and be gone."
"And Hareton's land, and his money," pursued the reckless thing. "Hareton and I are friends now, and I shall tell him all about you."
The master seemed confounded a moment. He grew pale, and rose up, eyeing her all the while with an expression of mortal hate.
"If you strike me, Hareton will strike you," she said, "so you may as well sit down."
"If Hareton does not turn you out of the room, I'll strike him to hell,"
thundered Heathcliff.
"Damnable witch! Dare you pretend to rouse him against me? Off with her! Do you hear? Fling her into the kitchen. I'll kill her, Ellen Dean, if you let her come into my sight again."
Hareton tried under his breath to persuade her to go.
"Drag her away," he cried savagely. "Are you staying to talk?"
And he approached to execute his own command.
"He'll not obey you, wicked man, any more," said Catherine. "And he'll soon detest you as much as I do."
"Whisht, whisht,"
muttered the young man reproachfully.
"I will not hear you speak so to him. Have done."
"But you won't let him strike me," she cried.
"Come then,"
he whispered earnestly. It was too late. Heathcliff had caught hold of her.
"Now you, go,"
he said to Earnshaw.
accursed witch. This time she has provoked me when I could not bear it, and I'll make her repent it forever.
He had his hand in her hair. Hareton attempted to release her locks, entreating him not to hurt her that once. Heathcliff's black eyes flashed. He seemed ready to tear Catherine in pieces, and I was just worked up to risk coming to the rescue, when of a sudden his fingers relaxed. He shifted his grasp from her head to her arm and gazed intently in her face. Then he drew his hand over his eyes, stood a moment to collect himself, apparently, and turning anew to Catherine, said with assumed calmness,
"You must learn to avoid putting me in a passion, or I shall really murder you sometime. Go with Mrs. Dean, and keep with her, and confine your insolence to her ears. As to Hareton Earnshaw, if I see him listen to you, I'll send him seeking his bread where he can get it. Your love will make him an outcast and a beggar. Nelly, take her, and leave me, all of you. Leave me!"
I led my young lady out. She was too glad of her escape to resist. The other followed, and Mr. Heathcliff had the room to himself till dinner. I had counselled Catherine to dine upstairs, but as soon as he perceived a vacant seat, he sent me to call her. He spoke to none of us, ate very little, and went out directly afterwards, intimating that he should not return before evening. The two new friends established themselves in the house during his absence, where I heard Hareton sternly check his cousin on her offering a revelation of her father-in-law's conduct to his father. He said he wouldn't suffer a word to be uttered in his disparagement. If he were the devil, it didn't signify, he would stand by him, and he'd rather she would abuse himself as she used to than begin on Mr. Heathcliff. Catherine was waxing cross at this, but he found means to make her hold her tongue by asking how she would like him to speak ill of her father. Then she comprehended that Earnshaw took the master's reputation home to himself, and was attached by ties stronger than reason could break, chains forged by habit, which it would be cruel to attempt to loosen. She showed a good heart thenceforth in avoiding both complaints and expressions of antipathy concerning Heathcliff, and confessed to me her sorrow that she had endeavoured to raise a bad spirit between him and Hareton. Indeed, I don't believe she has ever breathed a syllable, in the latter's hearing, against her oppressor since. When this slight disagreement was over, they were friends again, and as busy as possible in their several occupations of pupil and teacher. I came in to sit with them, after I had done my work, and I felt so soothed and comforted to watch them, that I did not notice how time got on. You know, they both appeared in a measure my children. I had long been proud of one, and now I was sure the other would be a source of equal satisfaction. His honest, warm and intelligent nature shook off rapidly the clouds of ignorance and degradation in which it had been bred, and Catherine's sincere commendations acted as a spur to his industry. His brightening mind brightened his features and added spirit and nobility to their aspect. I could hardly fancy it the same individual I had beheld on the day I discovered my little lady at Wuthering Heights after her expedition to the crags. While I admired and they laboured, dusk drew on, and with it returned the master. He came upon us quite unexpectedly, entering by the front way, and had a full view of the whole three ere we could raise our heads to glance at him. Well, I reflected, there was never a pleasanter or more harmless sight, and it will be a burning shame to scold them. The red firelight glowed on their two bonny heads, and revealed their faces animated with the eager interest of children. For though he was 23 and she 18, each had so much of novelty to feel and learn, that neither experienced nor evinced the sentiments of sober, disenchanted maturity. They lifted their eyes together to encounter Mr. Heathcliff.
Perhaps you have never remarked that their eyes are precisely similar, and they are those of Catherine Earnshaw. The present Catherine has no other likeness to her, except a breadth of forehead, and a certain arch of the nostril that makes her appear rather haughty, whether she will or not. With Hareton the resemblance is carried farther. It is singular at all times. Then it was particularly striking, because his senses were alert, and his mental faculties wakened to unwonted activity. I suppose this resemblance disarmed Mr. Heathcliff. He walked to the hearth in evident agitation, but it quickly subsided as he looked at the young man. Or, I should say, altered its character, for it was there yet. He took the book from his hand and glanced at the open page, then returned it, without any observation, merely signing Catherine away. Her companion lingered very little behind her, and I was about to depart also, but he bid me sit still.
"It is a poor conclusion, is it not?"
he observed, having brooded a while on the scene he had just witnessed.
"An absurd termination to my violent exertions. I get levers and mattocks to demolish the two houses, and train myself to be capable of working like Hercules. And when everything is ready, and in my power, I find the will to lift a slate off either roof has vanished. My old enemies have not beaten me. Now would be the precise time to revenge myself on their representatives. I could do it, and none could hinder me. But where is the use? I don't care for striking. I can't take the trouble to raise my hand. That sounds as if I had been labouring the whole time only to exhibit a fine trait of magnanimity. It is far from being the case. I have lost the faculty of enjoying their destruction, and I am too idle to destroy for nothing. Nelly, there is a strange change approaching. I'm in its shadow at present. I take so little interest in my daily life that I hardly remember to eat and drink. Those two who have left the room are the only objects which retain a distinct material appearance to me, and that appearance causes me pain, amounting to agony. About her I won't speak, and I don't desire to think. But I earnestly wish she were invisible. Her presence invokes only maddening sensations. He moves me differently. And yet if I could do it without seeming insane, I'd never see him again. You'll perhaps think me rather inclined to become so, he added, making an effort to smile, if I try to describe the thousand forms of past associations and ideas he awakens or embodies. But you'll not talk of what I tell you. And my mind is so eternally secluded in itself, it is tempting at last to turn it out to another. 5 minutes ago, Hareton seemed a personification of my youth, not a human being. I felt to him in such a variety of ways that it would have been impossible to have accosted him rationally. In the first place, his startling likeness to Catherine connected him fearfully with her. That, however, which you may suppose the most potent to arrest my imagination, is actually the least. For what is not connected with her to me, and what does not recall her? I cannot look down to this floor, but her features are shaped in the flags, in every cloud, in every tree, filling the air at night, and caught by glimpses in every object by day, I am surrounded with her image. The most ordinary faces of men and women, my own features, mock me with a resemblance. The entire world is a dreadful collection of memoranda that she did exist, and that I have lost her. Well, Hareton's aspect was the ghost of my immortal love, of my wild endeavours to hold my right, my degradation, my pride, my happiness, and my anguish. But it is frenzy to repeat these thoughts to you, only it will let you know why, with a reluctance to be always alone. His society is no benefit. Rather an aggravation of the constant torment I suffer. And it partly contributes to render me regardless how he and his cousin go on together. I can give them no attention any more.
But what do you mean by a change, Mr. Heathcliff? I said, alarmed at his manner, though he was neither in danger of losing his senses, nor dying, according to my judgment. He was quite strong and healthy, and, as to his reason, from childhood he had a delight in dwelling on dark things and entertaining odd fancies. He might have had a monomania on the subject of his departed idol, but on every other point his wits were as sound as mine.
"I shall not know that till it comes," he said. "I'm only half conscious of it now."
"You have no feeling of illness, have you?" I asked.
"No, Nelly, I have not," he answered.
"Then you are not afraid of death?" I pursued.
"Afraid? No," he replied. "I have neither a fear nor a presentiment nor a hope of death. Why should I? With my hard constitution and temperate mode of living and unperilous occupations, I ought to, and probably shall, remain above ground till there is scarcely a black hair on my head. And yet I cannot continue in this condition. I have to remind myself to breathe, almost to remind my heart to beat. And it is like bending back a stiff spring. It is by compulsion that I do the slightest act, not prompted by one thought, and by compulsion that I notice anything alive or dead, which is not associated with one universal idea. I have a single wish, and my whole being and faculties are yearning to attain it. They have yearned towards it so long and so unwaveringly that I am convinced it will be reached, and soon, because it has devoured my existence. I am swallowed up in the anticipation of its fulfilment. My confessions have not relieved me, but they may account for some otherwise unaccountable phases of humour which I show. Oh, God, it is a long fight. I wish it were over."
He began to pace the room, muttering terrible things to himself, till I was inclined to believe, as he said Joseph did, that conscience had turned his heart to an earthly hell. I wondered greatly how it would end. Though he seldom before had revealed this state of mind, even by his looks, it was his habitual mood, I had no doubt. He asserted it himself, but not a soul from his general bearing would have conjectured the fact. You did not when you saw him, Mr. Lockwood. And at the period of which I speak, he was just the same as then, only fonder of continued solitude, and perhaps still more laconic in company.
Chapter 34.
For some days after that evening, Mr. Heathcliff shunned meeting us at meals. Yet he would not consent formally to exclude Hareton and Cathy. He had an aversion to yielding so completely to his feelings, choosing rather to absent himself, and eating once in 24 hours seemed sufficient sustenance for him. One night, after the family were in bed, I heard him go downstairs, and out at the front door. I did not hear him re-enter, and in the morning I found he was still away. We were in April then. The weather was sweet and warm, the grass as green as showers and sun could make it, and the two dwarf apple trees near the southern wall in full bloom. After breakfast, Catherine insisted on my bringing a chair, and sitting with my work under the fir trees at the end of the house. And she beguiled Hareton, who had perfectly recovered from his accident, to dig and arrange her little garden, which was shifted to that corner by the influence of Joseph's complaints. I was comfortably revelling in the spring fragrance around and the beautiful soft blue overhead, when my young lady, who had run down near the gate to procure some primrose roots for a border, returned only half-laden and informed us that Mr. Heathcliff was coming in.
"And he spoke to me," she added, with a perplexed countenance.
"What did he say?" asked Hareton.
"He told me to be gone as fast as I could," she answered. "But he looked so different from his usual look that I stopped a moment to stare at him."
"How?"
he inquired. "Why, almost bright and cheerful. No, almost nothing. Very much excited and wild and glad," she replied.
"Night walking amuses him, then," I remarked, affecting a careless manner. In reality, as surprised as she was, and anxious to ascertain the truth of her statement, for to see the master looking glad would not be an everyday spectacle. I framed an excuse to go in. Heathcliff stood at the open door. He was pale, and he trembled. Yet certainly he had a strange, joyful glitter in his eyes that altered the aspect of his whole face. "Will you have some breakfast?" I said. "You must be hungry rambling about all night." I wanted to discover where he had been, but I did not like to ask directly.
"No, I'm not hungry," he answered, averting his head and speaking rather contemptuously, as if he guessed I was trying to divine the occasion of his good humour.
I felt perplexed. I didn't know whether it were not a proper opportunity to offer a bit of admonition. "I don't think it right to wander out of doors," I observed, "instead of being in bed. It is not wise, at any rate, this moist season. I dare say you'll catch a bad cold or a fever. You have something the matter with you now."
"Nothing but what I can bear," he replied, "and with the greatest pleasure, provided you leave me alone. Get in and don't annoy me."
I obeyed, and in passing, I noticed he breathed as fast as a cat. "Yes," I reflected to myself, "we shall have a fit of illness. I cannot conceive what he has been doing." That noon he sat down to dinner with us, and received a heaped-up plate from my hands, as if he intended to make amends for previous fasting.
"I've neither cold nor fever, Nelly," he remarked in allusion to my morning's speech, "and I'm ready to do justice to the food you give me."
He took his knife and fork, and was going to commence eating, when the inclination appeared to become suddenly extinct. He laid them on the table, looked eagerly towards the window, then rose and went out. We saw him walking to and fro in the garden while we concluded our meal, and Earnshaw said he'd go and ask why he would not dine. He thought we had grieved him in some way. "Well, is he coming?" cried Catherine when her cousin returned.
"Nay," he answered, "but he's not angry. He seemed rarely pleased indeed. Only I made him impatient by speaking to him twice, and then he bid me be off to you. He wondered how I could want the company of anybody else."
I set his plate to keep warm on the fender, and after an hour or two he re-entered, when the room was clear, in no degree calmer, the same unnatural appearance of joy under his black brows, the same bloodless hue, and his teeth visible now and then in a kind of smile, his frame shivering, not as one shivers with chill or weakness, but as a tight, stretched cord vibrates, a strong thrilling rather than trembling. "I will ask what the matter is," I thought, "or who should?" And I exclaimed, "Have you heard any good news, Mr. Heathcliff? You look uncommonly animated."
"Where should good news come from to me?" he said. "I'm animated with hunger, and seemingly I must not eat."
"Your dinner is here," I returned. "Why won't you get it?"
"Oh, I don't want it now," he muttered hastily. "I'll wait till supper. And, Nelly, once for all, let me beg you to warn Hareton and the other away from me. I wish to be troubled by nobody. I wish to have this place to myself."
"Is there some new reason for this banishment?" I inquired.
Tell me why you are so queer, Mr. Heathcliff. Where were you last night? I'm not putting the question through idle curiosity, but...
You are putting the question through very idle curiosity,
he interrupted with a laugh.
Yes, I'll answer it. Last night, I was on the threshold of hell. Today, I am within sight of my heaven. I have my eyes on it, hardly 3 feet to sever me. And now you better go. You'll neither see nor hear anything to frighten you if you refrain from prying.
Having swept the hearth and wiped the table, I departed, more perplexed than ever. He did not quit the house again that afternoon, and no one intruded on his solitude, till, at 8 o'clock, I deemed it proper, though unsummoned, to carry a candle and his supper to him. He was leaning against the ledge of an open lattice, but not looking out. His face was turned to the interior gloom. The fire had smouldered to ashes. The room was filled with the damp, mild air of the cloudy evening, and so still that not only the murmur of the Beckdown Gimmerton was distinguishable, but its ripples and its gurgling over the pebbles, or through the large stones which it could not cover. I uttered an ejaculation of discontent at seeing the dismal grate, and commenced shutting the casements one after another, till I came to his. "Must I close this?" I asked in order to rouse him, for he would not stir. The light flashed on his features as I spoke. "Oh, Mr. Lockwood, I cannot express what a terrible start I got by that momentary view. Those deep black eyes, that smile and ghastly paleness. It appeared to me not Mr. Heathcliff, but a goblin, and in my terror I let the candle bend towards the wall and it left me in darkness."
"Yes, close it," he replied in his familiar voice. "There, that is pure awkwardness. Why did you hold the candle horizontally? Be quick and bring another."
I hurried out in a foolish state of dread and said to Joseph, "The master wishes you to take him a light and rekindle the fire, for I dared not go in myself again just then." Joseph rattled some fire into the shovel and went, but he brought it back immediately with the supper tray in his other hand, explaining that Mr. Heathcliff was going to bed, and he wanted nothing to eat till morning. We heard him mount the stairs directly. He did not proceed to his ordinary chamber, but turned into that with the panelled bed. Its window, as I mentioned before, is wide enough for anybody to get through, and it struck me that he plotted another midnight excursion, of which he had rather we had no suspicion. "Is he a ghoul or a vampire?" I mused. I had read of such hideous, incarnate demons. And then I set myself to reflect how I had tended him in infancy, and watched him grow to youth, and followed him almost through his whole course, and what absurd nonsense it was to yield to that sense of horror. But where did he come from, the little dark thing, harboured by a good man to his bane? Muttered superstition, as I dozed into unconsciousness. And I began, half-dreaming, to weary myself with imagining some fit parentage for him, and, repeating my waking meditations, I tracked his existence over again with grim variations, at last picturing his death and funeral, of which, all I can remember, is being exceedingly vexed at having the task of dictating an inscription for his monument, and consulting the sexton about it, and, as he had no surname and we could not tell his age, we were obliged to content ourselves with the single word, Heathcliff. That came true. We were. If you enter the kirkyard, you'll read, on his headstone, only that, and the date of his death. Dawn restored me to common sense. I rose and went into the garden as soon as I could see, to ascertain if there were any footmarks under his window. There were none.
He has stayed at home, I thought, and he'll be all right today. I prepared breakfast for the household, as was my usual custom, but told Hareton and Catherine to get theirs ere the master came down, for he lay late. They preferred taking it out of doors under the trees, and I set a little table to accommodate them. On my re-entrance, I found Mr. Heathcliff below. He and Joseph were conversing about some farming business. He gave clear, minute directions concerning the matter discussed, but he spoke rapidly and turned his head continually aside, and had the same excited expression, even more exaggerated. When Joseph quitted the room, he took his seat in the place he generally chose, and I put a basin of coffee before him. He drew it nearer, and then rested his arms on the table and looked at the opposite wall, as I supposed, surveying one particular portion up and down with glittering, restless eyes, and with such eager interest that he stopped breathing during half a minute together. "Come now," I exclaimed, pushing some bread against his hand. "Eat and drink that while it is hot. It has been waiting near an hour." He didn't notice me, and yet he smiled. I'd rather have seen him gnash his teeth than smile so. "Mr. Heathcliff, master!" I cried. "Don't! For God's sake, stare as if you saw an unearthly vision."
"Don't, for God's sake, shout so loud," he replied. "Turn round and tell me. Are we by ourselves?"
"Of course," was my answer. "Of course we are." Still, I involuntarily obeyed him, as if I was not quite sure. With a sweep of his hand, he cleared a vacant space in front among the breakfast things and leant forward to gaze more at his ease. Now I perceived he was not looking at the wall, for when I regarded him alone, it seemed exactly that he gazed at something within 2 yards distance. And whatever it was, it communicated, apparently, both pleasure and pain in exquisite extremes. At least, the anguished yet raptured expression of his countenance suggested that idea. The fancied object was not fixed, either. His eyes pursued it with unwearied diligence, and even in speaking to me were never weaned away. I vainly reminded him of his protracted abstinence from food. If he stirred to touch anything in compliance with my entreaties, if he stretched his hand out to get a piece of bread, his fingers clenched before they reached it, and remained on the table, forgetful of their aim. I sat, a model of patience, trying to attract his absorbed attention from its engrossing speculation, till he grew irritable, and got up, asking why I would not allow him to have his own time in taking his meals, and saying that on the next occasion I needn't wait. I might set the things down and go. Having uttered these words, he left the house, slowly sauntered down the garden path, and disappeared through the gate. The hours crept anxiously by. Another evening came. I did not retire to rest till late, and when I did, I could not sleep. He returned after midnight, and, instead of going to bed, shut himself into the room beneath. I listened, and tossed about, and finally dressed and descended. It was too irksome to lie there, harassing my brain with 100 idle misgivings. I distinguished Mr. Heathcliff's step, restlessly measuring the floor, and he frequently broke the silence by a deep inspiration, resembling a groan. He muttered detached words also. The only one I could catch was the name of Catherine, coupled with some wild term of endearment or suffering, and spoken as one would speak to a person present, low and earnest, and wrung from the depth of his soul. I had not courage to walk straight into the apartment, but I desired to divert him from his reverie, and therefore fell foul of the kitchen fire, stirred it, and began to scrape the cinders. It drew him forth sooner than I expected. He opened the door immediately and said,
"Nelly, come here. Is it morning? Come in with your light."
It is striking four, I answered. You want a candle to take upstairs. You might have lit one at this fire.
No, I don't wish to go upstairs, he said. Come in and kindle me a fire and do anything there is to do about the room.
I must blow the coals red first before I can carry any, I replied, getting a chair and the bellows. He roamed to and fro meantime, in a state approaching distraction, his heavy sighs succeeding each other so thick as to leave no space for common breathing between.
When day breaks, I'll send for Green, he said. I wish to make some legal inquiries of him while I can bestow a thought on those matters, and while I can act calmly. I've not written my will yet, and how to leave my property I cannot determine. I wish I could annihilate it from the face of the earth.
I would not talk so, Mr. Heathcliff, I interposed. Let your will be a while. You'll be spared to repent of your many injustices yet. I never expected that your nerves would be disordered. They are at present marvellously so, however, and almost entirely through your own fault. The way you've passed these three last days might knock up a Titan. Do take some food and some repose. You need only look at yourself in a glass to see how you require both. Your cheeks are hollow and your eyes bloodshot, like a person starving with hunger and going blind with loss of sleep.